I was trying to think what's going to be necessary for everybody in this room if we're going to be involved, you and I together, in ministry. And something very obvious came to mind, almost too obvious to talk about. And I'd like you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I want to talk about how to continue loving the people you're going out to love. And keep on loving when you feel like strangling them instead. And make no doubt about it. If we could just get rid of all the people, ministry would be easy. The problem with the church is people. That's what the church is made up of. And when you live with them and serve them and model for them and care for them and marry them and bury them and care for their children, teach them and everything else, human love gets pretty thin. And what you're going to need is agape love, God's type of love, and a free flow of it forever. And I want to talk about that in relation to ministry today. So let's just read 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but haven't love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have a faith that can move mountains, but I haven't got love, I'm nothing. And if I give all I possess to the poor, surrender my body to the flames, but haven't love, I gain nothing. For love is patient and love is kind, and it doesn't envy and it doesn't boast. It isn't rude and it isn't proud. It's not self-seeking and it isn't easily angered. It keeps no record of wrong. Love doesn't delight in evil but rejoices with the truth, and it always protects, trusts, hopes, and always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease, and tongues, they will be stilled, and where there's knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. Now when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. And when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Follow the way of love. Chapter 14 got in the way of the end of that passage somehow. Follow the way of love is a very important place where that passage finishes, because it means make love your goal, make love your aim. And I don't know what your aim is here. I was hearing Stuart chat to one or two of the students behind me. What are you doing? I'm doing this. My goal is to teach, or my goal is to this, or my goal is to finish my biblical studies. Above and beyond all our intermediate goals has to be this goal. Follow this goal. Make love your aim, your goal, your overriding goal. Because you can be the best preacher that the world has ever had and the best teacher that the world has ever heard. But if you don't love the people you're going to, you can forget it. It's love that unlocks the key to their hearts. If they don't like you, they're not going to listen to you. And if they don't love you, you're not going to lead them. And God has to do that. Because, to put it frankly, we're not very lovable people. And so something happens to us in order for us to happen to them. And the something that has to happen to us as an incredible capacity for being able to receive the love of God and to allow that love of God to flow through us to other people. Then their mind will be a fertile field. They'll know. You know, I never wanted to work with women. I didn't like women particularly. I mean, I am one myself, and that's all right. But I wanted to work with kids. And when we came to the United States, the necessity was put upon me to work with women. And I fought it for quite a long time. And then, because, you know, I'll do what I'm told, I did it. I went down south and did some women's meetings. with a lady called Verla Pettit, who runs a rescue mission in Tennessee, in Nashville, Tennessee. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. She's in her 70s, late 70s now. She's still tramping the country and talking to anyone that will listen to her about Jesus. She's known all over Memphis, Tennessee. Every single bench, they have these benches where you wait for bus stop. She's commandeered and has the rescue mission stuff on them and managed to talk her way into the highest places in Tennessee for her drunks, as she lovingly calls them. As I watched that woman work with the women that weekend, I observed something. Yes, she was a good Bible teacher, but that paled into insignificance by the size of her heart. What a heart she had for those women. She loved them. Now, at that point, I didn't. And I knew I was doing a very good job, technically. But I knew that she knew I didn't love the women. When she took me to the airport, I knew I was in for trouble because she got me in the car and locked the door. I thought, oh dear. And as we went along, she said, "Now, Jill, you are one of the best speakers, technically, that we have ever had here. But I observe you don't love me." "No," I said, "I don't, and I don't want to. Because if I do, God will just give me more and more women to work with, and I want to work with the kids." She said, "Well, I just thought you'd be interested to know that it shows." Can you imagine being told that? Well, I knew that, but I didn't think it mattered. After all, I could teach them the Bible, and, you know, what did it matter whether I loved them or not? And then she said this. She said, "Jill, I love women. And that's why I love you. And I covet your gift for women. But you'll never get anywhere with them unless you let God give you his love for these women." And she prayed for me in that car, took it off the side of the road, and prayed that God would give me a love for women. It started with a willingness to have it. And from then on, God began to give me a ministry with women across the world. But it wasn't until I came to the challenge of realizing that however good a teacher I could be, they weren't going to listen. And they weren't going to do what I wanted them to do unless they felt that empathy from me and they knew I loved them. Now then, how's it all happen? Well, Paul says to the Corinthians, who knew all about Eros love, the feeling, sensual, sexual sort of love that lived in Corinth and worshipped the god of love on the big temple at the top of the hill. He said to them, "You really need to know how to love God style, not man style anymore." The Corinthians, as you know, knew a lot about sexual love. That's what the city was about. The economy of the city depended on the temple of Eros at the top of the hill. And now a bunch of them have been converted. And Paul said, "What I really need to do is teach them how love behaves. And teach them how to love. So that in contrast to all the loving that's being done on this sexual, sensual, feeling, touchy sort of level, they may begin to love each other as God loves them. That'll make a difference. Then everybody around are going to say, 'Look, behold how these Christians love one another.' That'll make them sit up and listen." And it does, you know. I think of the book of Ruth. Boaz said to Ruth, "The whole city knows about how you love your mother-in-law. Now you can bring Billy Graham to a city if you want, or you can start and love your mother-in-law." That will have a greater impact, I assure you. I mean, who loves their mother-in-law, right? But if Jesus can help us love our mother-in-law, the whole city is going to talk about it. Love really makes people talk. Especially in a society where no one loves anyone apart from Eros style, the feeling sort. If I feel I love my husband, I'll stick with him. If I don't feel I love my husband, I'll go and love somebody else's husband. If it feels so good, it must be right. Eros, phileo, human love. So Paul said, "What I need is a model. I really need a model." And he looked around and asked Jesus Christ to sit for the portrait, the word portrait that he paints for us here. And in verses 4 through 6, he takes apart for us a description of what it really is to love. Because I can come here and say you've got to love the people you're going to serve, and you know that anyway. I'm just reminding you of it. But how do I do that in practical terms? Love is not a feeling, the sort of love I'm talking about. Far deeper than a feeling. Yes, feelings get caught up in it, swept along with it. But the love of God is deeper than a feeling. The love of God is action. It's a thing of the head. It's gift love. God didn't feel very loving when he hung on the cross. Love is being primarily concerned with the other's well-being irrespective of the cost to itself. Love is saying, I love you whether you ever love me back or not. I love you when I don't feel like loving you. I'm going to love you whether you like it or not. Now, how do we do that? I'm not talking about a feeling, because Jesus said, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another. You cannot command a feeling. Now, this is wonderful news, because if love is a commandment, we can do it. Feelings will come and feelings will go. But if you will love God's style, you will do love, do the actions of love, and funnily enough, the feelings will follow behind. Love, let's look at it, bit by bit, is patient. The word means long-suffering. Paul had a few words to choose from. In the Greek, he chose people patience, not sickness patience, or being patient with circumstances. He chose the word for people patience. Love is very patient with people. Are you patient with people? This is a wonderful place to find out. Bible schools are marvelous places to practice love in this aspect. How patient are you with each other? Not with the people you like, of course, with the people you don't like. You'll have no problem with people that you like. Jesus said that. He said, so what? You like people that like you? Even the heathen do that. Are you trying to make friends here with people you don't like? There's your workshop. Who are your friends? One of the things you should do every week is start and make friends with someone here that you don't like. That's how you're going to practice people patience. Find out why you don't like them. What's making them behave in a way that irritates them? You. You'll find out why, perhaps, and that will help you be patient with them. Now, Paul uses a very interesting picture. He says, when I was a child, I talked like a child, thought, reasoned, behaved like a child. But when I grew up, I became a man. And I want to use that little picture all the way through this little talk. In other words, Paul said, children aren't patient. Now, think about it. I don't know how many of you are married with children. I'm sure all of you know children. All of you will have to deal with children in your ministry. And so you'll have to understand children. But I think we all know that children are not patient. I remember one of our grandchildren being pushed into his car seat and he didn't want to go into it. And when a child is about two or thereabouts or under two, they go like a board. They go stiff when they won't be put anywhere. Incredible. You just put them across the seat and they just are absolutely like a board. And I remember my son losing his fatherly patience with this 18-month-old, trying to put him in this seat that he wouldn't go in. And it's wonderful being a grandmother. You sit back and think, now how is he going to do this? You know, it's over for you. Well, he didn't do very well. He lost his patience. He thought of a good idea. He just gave the child a karate chop in the middle of his stomach. Boom. And that did the job wonderfully well. He howled, but that was all right. And he said, oh, I need more patience. I've run out of my phileo patience. For this he needed Jesus, but fortunately for this he has Jesus. For Jesus is the patient one. Jesus is God. God is long-suffering. How long-suffering is God? His long-suffering is described in the Old Testament, where it says he waited 120 years for people to say they were sorry in Noah's day. There's the picture. Let's measure ourselves by it. Do we wait 120 years for somebody to say they're sorry? 120 hours? Minutes? Seconds? How's our people patience? Well, if God knows how to be patient with a lot of rebellious children, He will give us himself by the Spirit, who will lend us his patience. And when we run out of ours, we appropriate, we draw on the patience of God. Love is very, very patient. When I was a child, I wasn't patient a bit, but then I grew up, said Paul. And to be mature as a Christian leader, teacher, helper, missionary, evangelist, whatever, you're going to have people patient. What's more, says Paul, love is kind. Kindness is the active side of patience. Patience is being good. Kindness is doing good. Because most of us aren't very sort of passive sort of people. We think of patience as passivity. It isn't really. It's active passivity. It's got a lot of self-control in there. But kindness is the doing side of patience. When I was a teacher in the back end of Liverpool hundreds of years ago, I needed a lot of little people patients. They used to send us out on playground duty. We used to call it vice patrol, actually. It was Liverpool, and those little children were cruel at their own level. Very cruel. How do children behave? Are they kind? I don't think children are very kind, little people. I have observed a lot of nastiness and cruelty from child to child. For example, name calling. Very typical among children. Sticks and stones may break my bones. Words will never hurt me. I don't believe that. I think words can hurt a child at a very deep level. And I've seen that on those playgrounds and with my own children, with any children. Being left out. Have you ever seen children playing a game and one little boy or girl wants to come and join in? And he's pushed away or he's left out and he's standing outside looking in instead of inside looking out. Do you know how cruel that is to a child? Paul said, that's how you're behaving in the church. Name calling. Leaving people out. That's childish. Grow up, he says to the Corinthians. If you're going to love, you don't do that. You include people. Even people you don't want to include. And you don't name call. Love is very kind. I was won to Christ by somebody being kind to me. In the face of my unkindness. Girl in the next bed, I was in hospital. Witness to me. And I was very, very unkind to her. Hostile. Unappreciative. I name called behind her back. Girl, really religious. Have you seen her? Etc., etc. What she did in the face of my badness was overcome it with goodness, and that's the idea here. Love overcomes evil with good. Goodness, kindness, same root. And what she did was shower me practically with, if somebody brought her flowers, she'd half them and put half on my locker by the time I came back from a test. There would the flowers be. If somebody gave her fruit, I would find it on my side. And the kinder she got, the worse I got to her. Because she was heaping coals of fire on my head. She was making me feel very warm and uncomfortable. That's what that means. And in the end, I said to her, why are you doing this? And she said, listen, Jill, if I was not a Christian, I would not be doing this. You are driving me nuts. But I have no alternative. I love you. And I said, what do you mean? She said, Jesus tells me I'm to be kind to you, even when you're unkind to me. And she won the right by being kind to have me listen to her and eventually won me to the Lord. Kindness. There's so little kindness out there. Go out into your ministry and just be kind. Do the kind thing. Look at the single parent struggling. Take her kids off her for the weekend. That's being kind. Do the practical thing. What's more, Paul says, if you want to know how love behaves, love doesn't envy. Envy is a very interesting word. It's in two parts, coveting and jealousy. Envy starts with coveting. Coveting says, I want what she's got. Now then, in ministry, you're going to have to struggle with this. I want the things other people have that I can't afford to buy because I'm in ministry. Some of you perhaps are coming into ministry from a second career. It's going to be hard, especially if you're married, for your wife. Perhaps she's had a house. Perhaps she's been able to get her kids' teeth fixed. Perhaps she's been able to provide the schooling. Or you've been able to provide the schooling together. Now suddenly all that is gone. And perhaps she'll have to go out to work to supplement the very meager salary you might get, etc. And it's very, very hard not to covet. I want what she's got. I used to struggle with that in the youth mission that we served for 14 years a little bit. It wasn't, funnily enough, only struggling it with for my own children, but it was struggling with it on the Lord's behalf. You'll struggle with it there, you know. We wanted a piano for the youth work that we were involved in. So we didn't have any money to buy a piano. We needed a musical instrument. So I put this advert in the paper. Has anybody got a piano? To my delight, a very rich, wealthy lady that I knew, who was not a believer, called me. And I thought, she's calling about the piano. We're going to get our piano. I couldn't stand it. So I said, is it about the piano? Yes, she said. Jill, we have just got a new Steinway. So would you like our old piano? And I don't know what it was. It was just the end of a long string of frustration. But I just got so angry. And I said, no, thank you. I'd like your new one. Whereupon she got very angry herself, and I didn't get either piano, the old or the new one, quite rightly, for my rudeness sake. But you know, I just got fed up with God getting the old piano. And you will. You really will. You'll know if you only had the resources, you could do this or you could do that. Or if you only had Bibles, all these people could do this or that. And what you get, the old piano. And I remember very angrily going to God and ranting and raving on my knees about this. Very quietly, the Spirit of God said to me, Jill, you often give me the old piano. This lady's not even a believer. What about the old piano you give me? He quietened me down. And I never did get a piano. But I got a guitar, which was a lot better. That was all right. But I tell you, love is kind and it doesn't envy. It doesn't say, I want what you've got. It says, I'm content with such things as I have, for God has said, he'll never leave me nor forsake me. And even as a full-time worker, you'll wrestle with this. When we came to the States, they asked us to sell up everything and just come with a couple of suitcases each. I thought that would be quite easy. We'd been in full-time work. I honestly didn't think that things had me, that I had things. And yet when I had to sell up everything and put one suitcase full of clothes and one suitcase full of things that I could keep, that was very, very difficult for me. All my wedding presents, all the things that perhaps didn't have value but did to me. When you actually had to get rid of them, it was a very good exercise. And I struggled with it. And I thought, well, I want what they've got. Why should I have to get rid of all my things? What overcomes envy and stops it growing into jealousy, which says, I don't want you to have it either. Coveting says, I want what you've got. Jealousy says, and I don't want you to have it either. How can you stop that happening? Love overcomes that, filling your heart, which brings the contentment with the one that you love, and the one that loves you. Think of David and Saul and Jonathan as an example. Saul was envious, the word is there, of David. Grew into jealousy. I want what he's got. I want his popularity. I want his good looks. I want his touch with the people. And what's more, I don't want him to have it either. So what did he do? He tried to kill him, right? And incidentally, that's where murder comes from. It starts with saying, I want what they've got. And I don't want them to have it either. Then you're in trouble. And so you go to means and ends to stop that happening. And Saul tried to kill David. Now, Jonathan was supposed to be king after Saul, right? And so his father said to him, why don't you hate him like I hate him? I can't understand you. He's after your throne. People are going to make him king, Jonathan. Let's get rid of him. And Jonathan said, Father, I love him. He can have my throne. What's more, when he's king, I'll serve him. That's love. And the love of God can overcome our coveting and our jealousy. For this we need Jesus, but for this we have Jesus. Are kids envious? Do you ever see children saying, I want what she's got? Do you ever see two kids pulling at a toy because they don't want them to have it either? That's how kids behave. Paul says, Corinthians, if only you can start and behave like I'm telling you to behave, the whole of Corinth is going to stop and look and therefore listen. Love is very patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't envy. Love doesn't boast. It isn't proud. I think in ministry there's a lot of chance to get proud. There's a lot of chance to keep humble too, I can assure you. But if the devil can get us proud, we cut ourselves off from all the help that we need. Proud that we've led someone to Christ. And maybe very humbly we'll talk about it. The Lord used me to really be a blessing. And somebody came to Christ. We can say it so humbly. But really it's inverted pride. We don't need to tell anybody. Jesus forbade people to publish his miracles. I think about that a lot. We publish books. And I ask myself, instead of seeking to publish books, is my heart attitude, well, if they want to publish them, fine. Do I want people to publish the miracle? Jesus was very... He did not arrive in a fiery chariot from heaven on the Milky Way. He was born in a bale of hay and set the world on fire. He crept into our environment, if you like. Love is not proud. What's going to stop us not being proud? A lot of worship. Like Isaiah, he worshipped God and he said, oh, woe is me, when he saw God. If you're going to stop saying, wow is me, that's the place at the feet of Jesus. A lot of worship. That'll stop you getting proud. Because when you get proud, your ministry just dries up. Absolutely dries up. Be able to say you were wrong. That's a good exercise. If you're wrong, be able to say, I was wrong. When you get married and have children, that's a great workshop. For a parent to be able to say to their child, I was wrong, makes a huge impact on the child. I remember our kids coming running out of the bedroom one day when Stuart had misjudged a situation and had gone in, sat on the bed and said, kids, I misjudged this. I was wrong. And I remember the kids congregating in the kitchen with big eyes. Oh, Daddy said he was. Daddy came and said he was sorry. Daddy said he was wrong. He didn't understand all the things. And they were really impressed that he'd been able to say, I was wrong. Can you say I was wrong? Pride won't let you say I was wrong. Pride is the Pharisee in you. Read Matthew 25, is it, where Jesus berates the Pharisees. And see if you can recognize the Pharisee in you. Don't say, oh, isn't that like so-and-so? They're a Pharisee. There is a Pharisee in each one of us. It's called the flesh. And if you read Matthew 25, the picture of the Pharisee, you will recognize him. He's in here. And he is a very proud, proud person, the old man, the Pharisee in me. Very proud. Love, says Jesus, isn't self-centered like that, which is the whole linchpin of this passage. Love isn't easily angered. And this is an interesting word. It means love doesn't have conflict or want conflict or look for fights or confrontation. Love is a peacemaker. And as you get out into ministry, you're going to have to learn to be a peacemaker. Now, don't wait till you get out into ministry. When you know there's conflict here in your group, practice being a peacemaker. Step out of your little environment, even though you don't think it's your business, and say, God, make me an instrument of your peace in this situation. You see, this is the environment you should be learning these things. Because when you go into your own group, it's just another group like this. And if you've learned these people skills here, and you've learned how to let God love through you, and bring peace where there's conflict, and help to bring brothers and sisters together who are at each other, then you just go out and do it over there where God is sending you. You know how to do it. Love isn't easily angered. It doesn't say, come on, let's have a fight. It has a covering quality to it. The atonement, God's love in action, had a covering quality to it. It doesn't expose evil, gossip about it. In other words, and another translation says, love doesn't gossip, doesn't delight in evil, doesn't spread evil around, doesn't delight in praying about it in the prayer meeting. Lord, we do pray for our sister so-and-so. She's struggling with her temper. That's gossip. What you can say is, Lord, we do pray for our sister Anne, who has asked for prayer, without mentioning what it is. But love does not delight in the evil. Love doesn't gossip. I often think of the Trinity sitting in heaven, and I'm so glad they're not gossiping about us. Can you imagine the Father saying to the Son, have you seen what Jill Briscoe did today? And the Son saying, oh, isn't it awful? And the Holy Spirit saying, well, I have to live inside you. You should try that. I mean, they don't sit up in heaven gossiping about us, delighting in the evil, chewing it over, passing it round, talking it, making sure each member of the Trinity has heard about it. They say, oh, did you see what Jill Briscoe did? The Father says, let's go down and cover it up. Let's go down and forgive it. Let's get it dealt with. Let's cover it. Love does not, therefore, keep any record of wrong. How good are you at forgetting what people do to you? You're going to have to work on that one. There are going to be people in the group that you go to serve who do not treat you kindly, who will perhaps try to get rid of you. At a recent pastors' conference Stuart and I were at, over 50% of the pastors in that conference had been fired from their church. Over 50%, this was in Canada. From churches that are very typical from around the world. There's nothing specifically difficult about the church in Canada. That can be repeated all over. How are you going to handle that if it should happen? Are you going to go through that very painful situation? And are you, for the rest of your life, going to keep a record of wrong? I met somebody since I've been in Australia that was now out of ministry. Apparently there are 10,000 pastors in Australia who were in ministry and now are back in business for all sorts of reasons, but mainly, probably, for these sort of reasons. I said, how long ago is it that you were in the ministry? And they had just told me how they had been thrown out of it. And he said, oh, 20 years, 18 to 20 years. And I thought to myself, no, it isn't. It's just like yesterday. For this poor man who had definitely been done in by that group of people had kept a running record of the wrongs for 20 years. And he couldn't forget. And he couldn't forget. And even though he was active in a church from his business capacity, he had kept an accounting of it. And that's the term. It's an accounting term. Love doesn't keep books. Love doesn't keep accounting. What they did to me 20 years ago. And so hopefully some people will do things to you while you're here so you can practice forgiving them. That doesn't give you permission to be nasty to each other. But if it happens, say, hallelujah, this is my chance to learn how to practice loving in this respect. Kids, do they tattle? Do they gossip? Do they keep a record of wrongs? Oh, yes. At the end of the day, when Daddy comes home, the kids all run to the door. Do you know what David did to me? 10 o'clock this morning? They've kept a running record of that. They've accounted it in their book to tell Daddy at the end of the day. Children are like that. We smile. It's childish. And Paul says to the Corinthians, grow up. Be mature. Don't do that. Learn to forgive. For love does not delight in evil, delights in the truth. And then Paul finishes this passage by saying, love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. The word protect means watertight. Are you watertight? In the sense of a boat never leaking. Can you keep a confidence? If somebody tells you something, do you leak it out? You've got to be able to keep a confidence. I've had to work hard at this. I find that difficult. If somebody tells me something, I have this incredibly evil desire, especially if it's juicy and interesting, to tell someone else about it. It's a horrible thing. It's the Pharisee in me. And what I have to do is to allow God to deal with that and to become trustworthy, watertight. Love always protects, is watertight. If somebody comes to you and says, will you not tell anyone this if I tell you? You've got to be able to say yes and mean it. And do it. Love always trusts. The word means ad infinitum. Always trust, not once. Again and again and again. If you have someone in your group who behaves in a way that is not right, can you trust them again? Can you allow them a leadership position again? Can you give them another chance? Paul found that very hard, even though he was writing about it. He could not give John Mark another chance. He said, I've trusted him once, and he let me down. That's it. Barnabas, however, demonstrated agape love. And he said, I'll give him another chance. And he and Paul had such a row over John Mark that they separated and their ministry went different ways. Paul had to learn what he was writing, as we all have to learn what we speak and what we write. Love always trusts twice, three times, four times. The young person lets you down. Can you give them another chance? Do you have that infinite capacity? Are you going into youth work? You've got to be able to trust twice, three times, four times, five times, ad infinitum, and give them another chance. Love does that. For this we need Jesus. I mean, we run out of our trust how many times? For this we have to. Love always hopes, has overwhelming confidence, always thinks the best. Not the worst, the best. And always perseveres. And that word means it's a lot of hard work. Does this sound like love? Stuart and I were watching a video last night that said, what is love? It was one of these foreign videos. I assure you, the love that it was speaking of was not the love that I am speaking of. It was incredible. It was all eros. There wasn't even any human love, like father to child in it. That whole video for 10 minutes or whatever it was eros. That is love, the feeling too big for words. There was no sense of the hard work of doing love. But then, says Paul, love never fails. Now, what does that mean? Lastly, what does that mean? You say, I don't agree with that. I have loved people, and it's failed. They have not responded. But it doesn't say love never fails to get a response. It says love never fails to love. Right? Whether you get a response or not. And what you're going to need out there is a love that failing to get a response never fails to go on loving anyway. That's the sort of love Paul speaks about here. Who is sufficient for these things? Not me, not you, but he is. For God is love. And Christ is God. And by his Spirit, he dwells in us.